Oh, baby.
Live from the Bay Area, the center of the universe, it's the Progressive News on Green 960.
You're going to love this. Just love it.
You are. You are gonna love it. Hey, who's that guy?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something right.
No, it's not.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
Not that scared.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me. Jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am stuck in the middle with you. Who am I? Brad Blog, your friendly citizen blogger from bradblog.com, sitting in for the vacationing John Scott today and tomorrow on your Progressive News show here on Green 960. Happy to be here broadcasting from the fine facilities of K-Talk, 1150 Progressive Talk down in Los Angeles. Up to you folks in the Bay Area. Glad you can be with us this afternoon. We got a big show. Thanks for having me. Coming up, we've got Representative Susan Davis on election reform down here in, well, she's from San Diego. We're going to have Eric Bollert from Media Matters talking about, Dan Rather, CBS, and what the hell is wrong with the mainstream media. Also, Mike Rogers, the man from Page One Q, blogactive.com, the man who outed Senator Larry Craig. He's going to be with us, and he promises a big scoop, plus green environmental news from Desi Doyen, daily voting news from John Gideon of Voters Unite, so much more, including your calls at 866-960-5753. Glad you could be with us. All of that coming up. But first, let's check in now with Green 960's Sebastian Coons with a news update. Oh, Sebastian, are you there?
I'm here, Brad. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Good to be here, my friend. What you got for us today?
Well, we got, you know, your typical thumbnail sketch of what the news looks like today. The latest breaking news from the past hour or so is occurring on the other side of the country. It's the place where thousands protested last week, and they're now feeling triumph out there in Jena, Louisiana.
Yeah, good news out there.
Michael Bell, a black teenager, had been charged with the attempted murder of a white classmate in Jena, now released on bail. The prosecutor says he'll no longer seek an adult trial for the teenager. Michael Bell's aggravated battery conviction had been thrown out by a state appeals court, which said that the 17-year-old, in fact, should not have been tried as an adult.
Nice. So raising hell works occasionally.
Occasionally. It seems like maybe you can fight City Hall.
That's good to hear.
Presidential politics from the Not Again file, maybe. A presidential debate occurring, a Republican, all-American presidential forum, in fact, is what it's called. It's for PBS. It's live, broadcast this evening from the campus of Morgan State University in Baltimore. And, Brad, you were telling me a little bit ago you have some more coming up on this story.
You can track it down for us. We hear that the top four Republican candidates are not coming at all, but they're going to have a empty podium for each of them. Why wouldn't they want to go, Sebastian?
I suppose it might have to do with the logic that, you know, if you're Giuliani, if you're Romney, if you're McCain, Fred Thompson, maybe all you could do is hurt your chances by appearing on this kind of debate.
By appearing before black people. Good thinking from the Republicans. That's going to work.
I don't know. I don't claim to be a politician by any stretch, but, you know, it seems like, what are we on, round number 9 or 10 with these Republican debates?
Exactly. But they're busy trying to make sure that those folks don't actually get to vote. And we're certainly going to cover that today and tomorrow, the African-American vote. They apparently don't want it because they don't even bother to show up at the debate.
Oh, man. Well, let's look at some local politics here. It's all kinds of local politics, in fact, from this week, because suspended San Francisco Supervisor Ed Ju is not planning to make a statement if asked to defend himself during Ethics Commission hearings. This week, his attorney made that declaration, saying Ed Ju's Fifth Amendment rights and protections would be infringed upon if he spoke out. Misconduct charges were filed this past Tuesday. It's the same day Mayor Gavin Newsom suspended Ju from the San Francisco Board of Supervisors and named Carmen Aaron Chu as his interim replacement representing District 4.
That you've got Chu replacing Ju. Did I get that right?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Indeed. And other major issue, we all knew about the auto worker strike this week, which ended after a couple of days. Private security officers here in the Bay Area, and now it's starting to go nationwide. They have been working without a contract for as long as 3 months. Negotiations resumed yesterday, and kind of as an act of goodwill, the workers tried, in most cases, to come back to work today. However, Gina, the spokesperson with SEIU 24/7, the security officers union, Gina Bauer's spokeswoman, says one company actually permanently replaced several of the striking security guards, and it's not over yet.
There's going to be a huge demonstration tonight in the financial district in San Francisco, starting at 4:30 at One Front Street. That's Front Market. We're going to be marching through the financial district with drums and whistles and chanting, and we invite everyone who wants to stand with security officers and take a stand for good jobs here in the Bay Area to come out and join us.
Apparently, three security guards that had been on strike were permanently replaced by the company that was employing them during this 3-4 day strike period. In fact, that company which terminated those employees, Universal Protection Services, did not return our calls for a reaction in this case. Finally, this Thursday afternoon, the Hamburglar, you might be aware of him from the McDonald's commercials.
Yeah, I am, actually.
He was never this lame. You might be aware of the change bins at McDonald's, which goes to the Ronald McDonald House Charities. Even if you don't admit to eating at McDonald's, you know about these charity change bins. Well, the San Francisco Police Department has arrested 29-year-old John Glass of San Francisco on charges of stealing one of the charity change bins from the Mickey D's on Haight Street. They had him on video. Even officers found him on the steps of a nearby church with about $100 in cash and change, and wearing the same hat he had on in the mixed security video. A restaurant manager actually told the San Francisco Examiner, "People trying to fish money out of these charity bins is a constant problem." I can't fathom that.
Wow, unbelievable! And of course, I can't get the Hamburglar out of my mind.
Well, this guy was not nearly that smooth, and the Hamburglar, if you remember right, was never smooth.
I do remember, and actually, I took a photograph with the Hamburglar about a month ago when I was on the road. He was at a McDonald's. We were there, and I put it up at Brad Blog with the caption, "Brad with unknown election official."
Wow, did he steal your food?
He tried.
Oh, okay, good.
He loves those burgers.
You can't stop him, really.
Yeah.
Green 960 Bay Area weather, looking for a cooler Friday to kick off the end of the week. A few more clouds, Coastside 2 tomorrow. Livermore might climb up to 70, but the city of San Francisco, only about 63 for a high. Right now, 84 in Santa Rosa, 66 in Oakland, 72 at Palo Alto. Here at the Green 960 studios, South of Market, San Francisco, 66 sunny degrees. I'm Sebastian Coons with Brad Friedman here on Green 960.
Hey, thanks, Seabass. That's
pleasure.
What they call you out here, right?
Indeed.
All right.
You've been briefed well.
I have. Thank you, Seabass. Appreciate it. We'll talk to you at the top of the next hour.
I'll be there.
All right, brother. Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break here. We've got Congresswoman Susan Davis coming up. She is emerging as a bit of a champion on election reform issues. Folks who know me from bradblog.com know I cover that beat quite a bit. We're going to talk to her about it. You can also jump into the chat room at bradblog.com. We've got an open thread at the top. I'm going to try to keep an eye on that as well. We'd love to see from you there. Taking a quick break, back in a few, with Congresswoman Susan Davis here on the Progressive News Show. We're back in a minute.
Filling in for us, Brad Friedman from Brad Blog on Green 960.
You can't touch this. Can't touch this.
Hey, thanks, John. Hope you're having fun over there.
Can't touch this.
All right, we're back on the Progressive News Show. I am Brad Friedman from BradBlog.com, sitting in for John. We've got Congresswoman Susan Davis on very momentarily. For folks who know me, who know bradblog.com, where we do have an open thread going on right now talking about the show, you can badmouth me all you want over there, or you can give us a call at 866-960-5753. I know you guys don't usually take calls on the show, but we wanted to make it really difficult for them up there in San Francisco. Anyway, for those who follow my work over at BradBlog, you know I cover election reform, and one of the big issues going on right now is a federal bill trying to work its way through Congress, specifically through the House, introduced by Representative Rush Holt. It's called H.R. 811, and it's going to add actually a lot of good protections for voting systems. However, one thing it doesn't do, among others, and there are many concerns with this bill, but it will not disallow touchscreen voting machines. It will, in fact, as I've argued, institutionalize them around the country. That, after what we've heard from California Secretary of State Deborah Bowen and her recent top-to-bottom review of all the voting systems in California, finding that touchscreen voting systems, otherwise known as DRE, direct recording electronic devices, should never be used because they don't work, they're not secure, they're inaccurate, all kinds of problems. Out here in California, Bowen has limited the use of such DRE touchscreens to just one per polling place to sort of minimally meet the federal disability voters standards. And now, with the Holt bill trying to get to the floor of the House, there's a lot of controversy around it. But it doesn't deal with these touchscreens at all as far as restricting them. That all changed a week or two ago when Congresswoman Susan Davis from California's 53rd Congressional District down there in San Diego finally spoke about what she called the 800-pound gorilla, whether or not we should use these touchscreen systems. She proposed an amendment and to restrict the use to one per precinct beginning in 2012. She joins us on the Progressive News Show. Congresswoman Susan Davis, thanks for joining us.
Hi. Nice to be with you. Thank you.
I really appreciate you taking time out. I wanted to get a sense of what the response has been from your colleagues, from other offices, Congress folks out there, because one of the things we've been told, those of us who have been calling for a full touchscreen ban, we've been to a DRE ban, we've been told, oh, there is no support in Congress for such a ban. Have you found that to be the case?
No, not necessarily, actually. I have a number of colleagues that have spoken to me about it, partly because of some of the interest out there, I think, and have also signed on to the bill. And we actually had a letter asking that the amendment come forward if, in fact, they bring the bill forward. And at this time, it looks like the bill itself is stalled. So I think we may not have that opportunity to bring it up, at least, you know, not in the immediate future.
We're kind of at that last step where it's in the House Rules Committee, and, of course, I'm learning about all this as well. That's sort of the last stop before it goes to the House, to the floor for debate, and in
right.
that
it did
rules...
come out of the committee.
It did not come out?
It did come out of the committee initially. That was quite a number, a few months ago.
Out of the Rules Committee?
No. It came out of the Election Reform Committee.
Right, in the admin. But now it's sort of stuck in the Rules Committee where they're deciding whether it will go to the floor or not and whether your amendment and others like it will be able to be added to it or debated. Is that correct?
That's correct. There are a few other amendments, one having to do with funding, seeing it as an unfunded mandate. That was one of the bills amendments that was already proposed.
And so you're hearing now, well, what are you hearing? Is this going to get out of the Rules Committee?
Think it's important to have a debate on this, whether or not we should allow touchscreen voting machines to be used in federal elections. But I think that for a number of reasons, they're taking another look at the bill itself. It's gotten to be quite complicated, as you know, and the issue of funding is certainly a big issue. And there's been a lot of opposition on the part of election officials around the country.
There has. And I suspect they're certainly going to be against any bill that tells them at the federal level how to, how they should run their elections. But do we have a need? What about their point? Do we have a need for federal oversight in addition to the Help America Vote Act from 2002 at this point?
Well, I think we do. I think part of the difficulty is just really getting the discussion out there and allowing us to really talk about the touchscreen voting machines. You know, initially I didn't necessarily see them as a major problem, but I've come to realize that just even the setup, if you take aside the issues of whether or not there's some opportunity there for any kind of manipulation. At the same time, we've got difficulty in setting them up. We have maintenance problems. And in the long run, they're far more expensive for counties to use and to really administer. What we need is a paper ballot. And I think that while some of those machines could cause some difficulties from time to time, they really don't have the built-in problems that touchscreen voting machines do now.
Well, bless you for taking notice of that and speaking up. It's been extraordinary. You know, just the day after your amendment was, I think we broke the story at Bradblog, that night, actually, the New York Times came out with an editorial calling for a complete ban on touchscreen voting systems, saying that it should be added to the Holt bill in the House and the Feinstein bill in the Senate, and that it shouldn't wait for 2012. It should be by 2008. What do you think of that idea?
Well, I think that in some ways when we put the 2012 there, it was a kind of compromise and wanting to be sure that people have the ability to be able to switch over if they, in fact, are using the touchscreen voting machines. But we've actually found that in many cases, I think they have the ability to use other machines that even can be rented in some cases. But, you know, that's really what we put forward because it was consistent with the bill and we thought it had a greater chance of being accepted if we use that particular deadline. But I know that, you know, the New York Times and other groups have certainly come out and said, you know, let's get it together by this next election.
And why do you think there has been this initial hesitance at all in Congress to even discuss, like you said, when you sent me a statement talking about this as the 800-pound gorilla that people in Congress would just not talk about? What's been the holdup? Why have they not even discussed this topic, you suppose?
I think largely because a lot of counties went forward with HAVA. They, you know, felt like it had been important for them to move forward, and there's a lot of concern that a lot of this money has been spent, and perhaps, you know, voters would say that, you know, it's being wasted now. I think we feel that taking a look at this switch would be a very important one in the long run, would probably save money in counties.
We're speaking with Congresswoman Susan Davis from the 53rd Congressional District in California. Just very quickly here, I know you have a couple of other election reform bills that are working their way through for no-fault absentee ballots for everyone in America. Are these bills getting any traction? Are they moving?
Actually, I think that particular one will have a hearing coming up soon, and We do have some support for that, and I think that in those communities, in those counties, in those states where they require pretty massive amount of authorization, whether it's from a physician, you know, if someone can't make it to the polls, whether they need somebody to verify that, in fact, they have an issue with voting, I'm hopeful that we're going to get some attention from individuals from those particular areas. In California, of course, we have no excuse absentee voting, but there are so many, 26 other states that require so much, and we think that it should be universal. Everybody should have an equal chance of being able to vote at home if they so choose, and we know that in many communities, absentee voting has worked very well, and we need to continue to be vigilant about that method. But I think we're in California, we're going to see quite a bit of absentee voting because the Secretary of State, as you know, has basically said that we're not going to be using touchscreen voting machines in the next election.
Well, I hope folks
only one per precinct and pre-election day.
Well, I do hope the folks use absentee balloting only as a last resort. It's always better, always safer, always more secure, I think, to vote on paper at the ballot precinct on election day. But obviously, if you can't or if you must use a touchscreen machine wherever you may live, then absentee is certainly a better option than that. Congresswoman, I appreciate you spending taking out a few minutes here to talk with us tonight. And I appreciate you raising this topic, the 800-pound gorilla, as you mentioned in Congress. And I hope you will keep championing these election reform issues in the House. We
Thank
really
you.
Need
I certainly
a champion.
Will. Thank you for your support as well.
You got it.
Uh-huh.
Thank you, Congresswoman Susan Davis from California's 53rd District down in San Diego. All right, we're going to jump on over to Eric Bollert here shortly. Actually, let's go ahead and take a break so we don't have to interrupt him. We're going to jump out, take a quick break, come back with Eric Bollert from Media Matters on Dan Rather, CBS, and what the hell is wrong with the mainstream media, even while we're sitting here talking on it. You're listening to the Progressive News Show. Brad Friedman in for John Scott. We'll be back right after this.
Hey, this is fun. I get to be the announcer for my own show. Filling in for me while I'm on vacation, the fabulous Brad Friedman on Green 960.
Fabulous. Speaking of fabulous, we're going to have Mike Rogers from Page One Q and Blog Active coming up next hour. Our own Desi Doyen with a Green News Report a little bit later this hour.
Some folks are born made to wave the flag.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh, they're red, white, and blue.
But this hour,
and when the band plays,
it's all about George Bush, that fortunate son. No, we're not the fortunate ones, but George W. Bush is. And yeah, it's that same old story. We're not letting it go. I got an email a couple of days ago from Eric Bollert of Media Matters saying, yeah, I can't let it go either. Dan Rather, if folks have been paying attention, Dan Rather has filed a lawsuit against his old bosses at CBS for some $70 million because they threw him off the bus, threw him under the bus, whatever it is. They threw him out for reporting a story that was true, that George W. Bush went AWOL from the Texas Air National Guard. Eric Bollert can't let it go, neither can I. Eric joins us from Media Matters. How are you, my friend?
I think I think in the email I said I like banging my head against the wall.
Yeah, right. Well, I guess you got to. But, you know, this is important, and there's a reason why I wanted to bring you on to talk about this, and not to dredge up this old topic,
right,
but the reason why it's important. So first, let's start out here. Dan Rather's story was correct, was it not?
Well, yeah. I mean, the central contention of that CBS report was that Bush got help getting into their National Guard, and he got help getting out. I was writing about this in 2004 at Salon extensively, and I always told people the story wasn't really how he got in; it was how he got out. I mean, he landed in the so-called Champagne Unit of the Texas Air National Guard. There were lots of people pulling strings. I mean, ever since Dan Quayle ran for vice president, it's been sort of an open secret that during that era, lots of rich kids got in. What Bush did that was so unusual is, you know, he got in, he leaped over 500 people on the waiting list. His application was mediocre beyond belief, but they made him an offer. I mean, he got every gift, and then two or three years into it, the arrogance was enough, and they decided, I'm not going to show up anymore. Not only am I just hanging out in Texas on the weekends while 350 Americans die every week in Vietnam, I'm going to take it to another level. I'm just not going to show up for 2 years.
Yeah,
in one sense, you got to give it, you got to hand it to the guy. You know? He's driving around in his convertible. He's got the ultimate, sweet spot on the Air National Guard, and then he says, "You know what? I'm not even going to go for a couple of years."
Yeah, you could hand it to the guy if he didn't turn around, do what he's done, and most specifically, even this week, come out and say and call people who asked, you know, in an ad for crying out loud, "General, betray us?" Question mark.
Right.
You know, and call that disgusting and an attack on all of our military.
Right.
When this guy scrammed. Now you report over at Media Matters, Eric Bollert, that you went through, I think it was 10 points you went through 10 different points that you've got this guy nailed dead to rights that have nothing to do with the memos that
right.
Dan Rather used as a small piece of his story. And by the way, those memos have never been proven to be forgeries, but you say that there are 10 points at least which make the story true that have nothing to do with those memos. Can you hit one or two of those for us just to underscore this?
And to give people credit, I mean, these sort of discrepancies were dug up online by people like Marty Held and Paul Lukasiak and Robert Rogers,
right,
who all did this independently between 2001 and 2004, and they all got the same batch of documents, and they all saw the same sort of gaping holes. Well, for instance, I mean, when Bush entered the Guard, he signed a statement that said flying was his lifetime pursuit, and he promised he'd fly for the Guard for 60 months. And when he was done with his training, he owed 53 more months, but he only flew for 22 of those months by the time he was discharged. So he had, almost 30 months that he didn't fly that he promised that he would.
And do we have a document that says this is my lifetime pursuit and I promise to fly for 60 months?
Yeah, he had to sign it when he entered. You know, when he entered, that's standard. Everyone's got to do it because, you know, in theory, they don't want to just, you know, they spent $1 million to train the guy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the Air National Guard didn't just want to sort of give people, well, gee, I think I want to be a pilot or you know, I think I really want to work for Pan Am. I mean, they're trying to find people that, A, want to be pilots and, B, you know, will, might make the military a career. I mean, that statement didn't specifically say that. But the idea was, we don't want to spend $1 million on you and then you disappear. Little did they know they were going to spend $1 million on him and then he was going to disappear even before, you know, his tour of duty.
He disappeared. We know for a fact. We've got the documents say that he only flew for 22 of the 53 more months of flying that he promised that he would that he was owed. Okay. And I'm hitting these for a specific reason, just a couple of them, because I'm going to move to the media next, and why the hell they're not getting this right.
Well, another one was he failed, he refused to take his mandatory physical in the summer of 1972, and that should have prompted something called the Flying Evaluation Board. Anytime he got grounded, therefore, I mean, he didn't take his physical, therefore he was grounded. Anytime an officer, a pilot was grounded, a fully trained pilot, there's supposed to be a Flying Evaluation Board. To investigate the circumstances, because again, they just spent $1 million on the guy.
And so, how do we know that he didn't take his physical?
Oh, that there's documentation from the from his commander. Actually, I think this one came from Denver, which is where the personnel center was, and it came to his commander. There was a list of like 10 or 12 people on that sheet of paper. It was signed off by the general personnel saying, Lieutenant Bush has been grounded, and it checked off the box why. There's paperwork, but what there isn't is any evidence that a flying evaluation board was ever convened. This is another example of how his Bush's superiors were sort of covering for him.
All right. Now, you list about another 8 similar items.
Yeah, very detailed, all based on paperwork trail or their lack of.
Paperwork.
As we're going to point out, the press just absolutely had no interest.
Well, that's what I said. Paperwork about which there is no question, unlike particular rather documents for part of that story.
Right. These are straight from the Documentation Center in St. Louis. If you send in a Freedom of Information request, this is 162 pages you're going to get. No one in the White House has ever questioned, the contents of any of these documents.
And no one has ever questioned the content of at the White House, has ever questioned or gone on record concerning Rather's report, the content of that report, correct?
That's right. They can't. I mean, it's overwhelming evidence. And
he's dead to rights.
The only thing they did was not seriously question the facts.
Okay, then. Fine. We turn now to the liberal media, the Washington Post, that liberal bastion of liberalism. Howard Kurtz, their media guy, of course, he saw Dan Rather's lawsuit, and he said, well, finally, Dan Rather is speaking up because his story was true, and it's about time that he got some accountability from CBS for firing him, right? What, you're laughing?
Well, not quite.
Didn't go that way?
Because as I point out in my piece, you got to understand the press culture. It's not just the Beltway, but it's really, from D.C. to Boston, so it includes New York. And everyone wants to be one of the cool kids. And, 2 weeks ago, if you wanted to be a cool kid, you had to agree that Move On was a disgrace. And last week, if you wanted to be a cool kid, you had to write about what a jerk Dan Rather is. I mean, these are unspoken rules that evolve rapidly, but everyone understands what page you want to be on if you want to be one of the cool kids. And absolutely, the talking point, the media talking point, was Dan Rather is crazy, he's delusional, he's bitter, he's arrogant. I think Ted Koppel from ABC was the only one that said, that sort of came forward and said, good for Dan Rather. And Eugene Robinson of the Washington Post wrote a column saying, there's more here than meets the eye. But everyone else was just snickering, making fun of him. And the people who wrote all this stuff, as I pointed out in my column, don't have the slightest idea what the facts of the Air National Guard story.
And this wasn't just Washington Post. On CNN's Reliable Sources, which Howard Kurtz also hosts,
right.
He has a stack of panelists. You quote them as calling rather sad, pathetic, arrogant. Newsweek had a report on this, calls him a pathetic loser
right.
for the fact that he got the story right.
Right. But the Howard Kurtz, there was an online, one of these chats, and someone said, well, isn't that story, just because the documents were wrong or inauthenticated, couldn't the story be right? And then Howard Kurtz wrote, no, that's not the way it was. They use these documents, they claim they're exclusive, and once they didn't work out, you cannot now claim the story is accurate. And I said in my column, think of it as a trial. I said, everyone knows that if one piece of evidence is discredited, that means the whole case is flawed. Right?
Well, that's what the claim, yeah. If one piece is bad, they have to completely exonerate the guy.
Right, so that's the rule, that's sort of the basis that the Beltway Press is using for rather.
Well, what about the liberal media down there at the Los Angeles Times? Surely they backed up.
They had this weird obsession with Dan Rather last week. They wrote three separate sort of scathing condemnations of Dan Rather. One, they even wrote it. They published an unsigned editorial. But their media columnist claimed that Rather's report was wholly unsubstantiated. But that is the talking point.
And
again, the problem is, the reason there's this sort of blanket ignorance is the press ignored the story in 2000, except for the Boston Globe, which broke the story.
Mm-hmm.
And then they mostly ignored it in 2004. And then when the CBS memo story came up, they ran, not walked away from the story. So here we are in 2007, and most journalists still don't have the slightest idea what the facts of the case are.
So you're suggesting that this is about them not having covered it themselves, and
right.
therefore they turn it into a non-story, even though
it is
a story.
Well, they haven't covered it themselves, and the media that they read and write, the media they consume, hasn't covered it at all. I mean, if you go back to the 2000 campaign, again, Walter Robinson, to his credit, Boston Globe laid out a lot of these facts, not the ones, the real specific stuff we were talking about, but the very general holes in Bush's military record. He front page story in May of 2000, ABC News for the entire 2000 campaign never once mentioned that there were questions about George Bush's Vietnam service. They went through the entire campaign. Boston Globe ran that story on page one. A week later, Chris Matthews had a one-hour interview with George Bush. Never once asked him about the Boston Globe story that was based on his own military records that showed he didn't show up for months, and quoted his old commander saying he never showed up.
Well, it's not like
that is not, gee, I never heard of the story. That is reading the story and making a conscious decision, I'm not going to touch it.
Well, it's not as if we were at a time of war and in the middle of a campaign where they were attacking an actual war hero, someone
right.
who didn't go AWOL. It is just amazing what the media does. I got another quick question or two here for you, but I want to note that Agent 99 in the bradblog.com chat room wonders if Bush's trip to the mission accomplished carrier deck counts for the hours that he still owes, Eric. That's one question. And another is, at one point I want to make that apparently San Francisco Examiner actually says that Rather indicates that he may actually be calling, that he
right.
does not plan to settle this thing. He may actually be calling both Bushes, 41 and 43, to testify in his trial.
That's right. It could be a very interesting case. He says he's not going to settle. He's not interested in the money. If he gets any money, he's going to give it to charity and journalism organizations. He seems committed to this. And it sure would be interesting to get a lot of these players under oath. I see it as having the potential of a Paula Jones situation, where once you start hiring lawyers and issuing subpoenas, this thing, you never know where these things are going to go. But the press sees it as completely unnewsworthy, except for a couple outlets like the San Francisco paper and a couple others who have looked at it seriously, saying this is where it could go, this is where he might have trouble. Most of the press coverage is just sort of, you know, the journalists are just sort of tripping over themselves to make fun of Dan Rather.
I think
it has the potential to be a very newsworthy undertaking.
Yeah, I would say so. Eric Bollert from Media Matters, thanks for jumping in with us today on the Progressive News. Really appreciate having you here, and please stay on the story and don't let these guys get away with it, Eric.
Talk to you soon.
Got you back, brother. Thanks. Eric Bollert from Media Matters. We're going to take a quick break. Come back with Desi Doyen and the Green News. You guys, Green News report for us? All right. Yeah, some environmental news coming up since it is Green 960. Brad Friedman of bradblog.com sitting in for John Scott, who's sipping Chianti over in Italy or something like that. We're back with much more ahead right after this.
This is John Scott. Thanks for enjoying Brad Friedman filling in for me while we're on vacation. And make sure you visit his tremendous website, bradblog.com. This is Green 960.
Not easy being green. It seems you blend in with so many other ordinary things.
All right, well, you know, guest host, too. We can't get all those cues right. We're making this up as we're going along.
Because you're not standing out.
Be in the media.
Why she sparkles in the water or stars in the sky.
Brad Friedman from BradBlog.com sitting in for John Scott. As John said, figured, hey, we're doing a Green 960 show here. Why don't we do a little Green News on Green 960. And so I asked my local producer down here, Desi Doyen, to jump in with a Green News report. And, of course, that's your theme song, Des.
Thanks.
You
that's
like
really,
it?
Yeah. That's like amazing and awesome.
Yeah, thank you for noticing. You know.
Yeah, I couldn't find anything better.
You got a problem with it?
Different. Well,
all right,
no,
I'll work on it for tomorrow.
It's quite easy being green, right. But, you know, there's a lot more we can do to talk about that.
All right, well, give us a rundown. What's going on in green news this week, Des?
Well, there's always a lot going on, but the biggest green news this week is the fact that we had competing international summits on climate change, 3 this whole week, all by themselves.
Really?
Yes, so the largest one was held on Monday at the United Nations in New York. Now, this is a one-day summit. It was attended by more than 80 nations and world leaders. And according to UN General Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, the summit was intended to, quote, spur conversation and bring global policymakers together to make common cause in finding solutions to our common problem. Now, at the UN meeting, developing nations urged the richer economies to honor their pledges to curb greenhouse gas pollution and also to help poor nations cope with the impact of climate change. Now, the difference with this UN summit was that President Bush did not attend it. In fact, he opted instead to host his own two-day summit in Washington.
He didn't even go to the UN summit?
He did not go to any of the official stuff. He went to one sort of private informal dinner gathering, and that was it, because he's going to have his own summit, which started today in Washington, D.C.
With a summit, don't you have to be... Who is he summiting with?
He's summiting with all of the major polluters in the world and also with all of the European Union countries as well. So now what he did at the U.S. conference, which I already said started in Washington today. Now, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice started with that, and she was the opening speaker. She insists that the U.S., quote, takes climate change very seriously.
This is the U.N. summit, right?
No, this is the U.S. summit.
This is Bush's summit.
This is Bush's summit.
Bush has a summit with his own Secretary of State.
Yes, okay. He's the keynote speaker.
This
and
is going to work out
sure
well.
That we, you know, take it very seriously. And, you know, Bush rejected the Kyoto protocols. And the U.S. agenda is basically to continue to resist any binding or mandatory targets and call instead for voluntary approaches.
Of course.
And with an agreement of further study on how they're going to proceed. Not what they're going to do, but to talk about how they're going to talk about it.
They're going to talk about how they're going to talk about it.
Right. How
not
they're going
what
to go
they're
going
about
to do. They're going to study how they're going to
how
do
they're
it.
Going to talk about talking about how to get voluntary.
Exactly. The voluntary approaches
good.
Could be
good.
And how they might go about getting those voluntary approaches.
I'm breathing easy already.
And using those aspirational long-term goals. They call it aspirational.
Mm-hmm.
So the let's see. So Bush was criticized by UN diplomats who accused him of attempting to derail the UN initiative on climate change by hosting his own little conference. One diplomat described the separate meeting as a spoiler. Another said the conference was aimed at domestic policies and politics, so that Mr. Bush was trying to seek headlines and television coverage, implying that he was doing something about climate change while in fact doing almost nothing. The Danish environmental minister, who's attending the UN conference, not the Bush conference, told members of Congress that the nations of China and India will not do anything unless the U.S. is moving. So what we're hoping to do is, you know, get the U.S. to come along, because then China and India will follow.
Of course they will. I see no problem with that plan. George Bush has got it figured out.
Yeah.
Desi Doyen, thank you very much for that update. We'll have another one tomorrow.
Yeah, we'll do it.
I'll find a new theme song.
Okay.
Maybe. You're listening to Progressive News on Green 960. We're back after this.